Welcome to this track. It's my honor to introduce you the famous Randy Easter. I'm not going to read through the bio sheet that I'm holding here now, since I have been, I get to know him for so long. When I get to know him, he was the NIST CMP director, and he holds that position for 11 years, from 2003 to 2014. And during that period, he did everything, reviewed the report, audited our lab, updated the IGs, answered enormous number of the questions, and thank you for that. And I think currently, his primary responsibility is the technical expert and the principal editor, co-auditor of the ISO standard. Yeah, it's a big set of the ISO standard, altogether seven draft standards, and he is the editor of the two published ISO standards and the one that is published, the technical specification. So he will tell you all of the exciting things happening with the ISO standard. And here you are. Please welcome.
Thank you very much. The title of my presentation is the overview of the revision that was published last December. But I thought before I do that, since there really was not a tremendous number of changes in the revision, is kind of go over a little bit of the history of the program. I mean, there's a lot of talk here, which is very good, especially Matt Keller with the CMUF, as far as moving forward, you know, what directions one should go, where things need to be improved, where things to be added. But I think it's very important to understand what the original intent of the program was, what the original purpose of the standard. And unless you're as old as I am, it's been here for a long time, 25, almost 21 years now. And there's probably a number of people in here who were in high school then, or even earlier. So I think it's important to understand where we came from and to help move forward in that respect. So I'm going to talk about where we were and why are we here. And then we'll go into the differences in the correction that was published last December 15th in both 19790 and 24759. Which are the two primary ISO standards. So why? Back in the early 90s, the federal government wanted to look into what could be done to improve the security and technical quality of cryptographic modules employed by the federal agencies, both US and Canada, which then developed into the joint program between the NIST and CSE or CSEC, or back to CSE now. So NIST developed standards. And so there was a process put in place between developers, manufacturers, industry, to create FIPS 140-1. So research was done to define what the set of minimum requirements, and I want to say practical requirements. We don't want to develop standards that cannot be practical and we can't build products to. So minimal and practical requirements for cryptographic modules to be used by federal agencies. This was also based on a set of four minimum security assurance levels based on the usage environment. If you look at FIPS 140-1 and -2, it's really how do you protect the critical security parameters, how keys are protected, in addition to getting implementing cryptographic algorithms. So it also references what are considered the approved security functions to be used within the federal government, including key establishment methods. One thing to stress, FIPS 140-1, -2 does not address vulnerability analysis. It was deemed that that was going to be addressed by common criteria, which emerged in the early 2000s. So it's a set of conformance tests. The module shall do this. If it's tested, it does that. You pass. And there was a lot of emphasis to, based on the cost and time, cost to the manufacturer, how much time to get through the process, because generally the validation is based on the most recent version of the module that the manufacturer is going to market. You don't want to be hung up in a testing lab for months and months and hung up in the validation process and then find out that they're already migrated to the next version of the product. That really has no value to anyone. So part of the conformance testing is it is conformance, it should be black and white, and cost and time sensitive so that you can get through the process in a reasonable amount of time or as quickly as possible. In addition, this testing to be done by accredited independent third parties to do the conformance testing. Really because NIST does not have the staff or folks to be able to do that conformance testing. Maybe in the beginning of the program when one or two modules were being validated every couple months, but not today when it's one a week that could be go through the validation process. So the volume has greatly increased. And then after the testing, the validation of those test results. So that's the mission that was formed back or conceived back in the early 1990s. So I'm going to go a little bit of my personal experience of what I call pre-FIPS. We now have FIPS, and where we are today and where we may move forward using the international standards, ISO standards. So some of this, I'm going to use my own personal experience in this because I've been involved in cryptographic module development and hardware for many, many years. Initially with a small company, IBM. And back in the 80s, so this is a while ago, we built our first cryptographic coprocessor to be attached to the IBM 3090 mainframes. This coprocessor was integral right into the processor itself, provided very high performance cryptography, very highly secure cryptography, and a rich set of functions, banking functions, the encryption, key management, and all those things. In those days, we were using ECL logic. CMOS had not matured enough yet to have sufficient performance. So we had this TCM with 100 or so custom ASICs attached with a fire hose to what we called the key storage unit. And inside that, you can see with the dotted lines, is a thing that we called the brick. That was the secure cocoon where the master keys or keys are kept. That was developed between IBM Poughkeepsie, where I was, and Watson Research Center in Hawthorne. And I would say that, in a sense, in hindsight, was probably over-engineered and probably came to as close to tamper-proof as one could engineer. Today we talk about tamper-resistant, but I think this was very close to tamper-proof. So we built this for these mainframes. We didn't have a FIPS standard. So what do we have to do to market this? How do you market that? Well, it's easy. We have this functionality. We have these suite of crypto functions. We do key management. It's highly secure. No one can get the master keys. So how do you market that? Well, I personally had to go to our customers, generally the banking industry in Europe, carrying these parts and pieces sawed in half through customs, through x-ray machines. I was caught once or twice. I thought I had a bomb, I think. And talk to the banks and ask, say, look, it's secure. I can show you. We cut it in half. You can't get inside. And the feedback was, well, okay, we believe you, but we really would like to have an independent consultant take a look at it and give us their feedback as far as or their opinion of what we've engineered. The problem with that is we don't want to share our proprietary design implementation with all these various consultants, and we don't understand from consultant to consultant if there's any consistency in what they're looking at or what they're going to report. So it was largely based on the customer trusting us that what we built was secure and correct implementation, got the right answers. Trust us, and by the way, don't trust our competitors. They're not secure because there's no baseline. So that's what we did before we had a FIPS standard. We build it, trust us, it's secure, and don't trust our competitors because they don't know what they're doing. After that, the how was the development of FIPS 140-1, which was published in 1994. And again, this was a collaborative effort between industry, government, and academia, public input, public comments, of which the approval authority is the Secretary of the Department of Commerce, which means any changes you want to make to the standard has to go through the Secretary of the Department of Commerce. A national body or a validation program, if they don't like things in the standard, the standard writers may come decide they don't like it either. We all may decide we don't like it. But there is a process for changing it, and it takes the signature of the Secretary of the Department of Commerce to do that, which is why one of the roles of the CMVP is implementation guidance, why implementation guidance cannot change the requirements of the standard, because that's not signed by the Secretary of the Department of Commerce. Secondly was the accreditation of laboratories. First three labs in July of 1995. Today we have both domestic and international labs. They go through, NAVLAP has a process, a biannual set of site audits, and continuous review. We talk about, you know, the CMVP reviews reports. Really, that's not a CMVP activity. That is a NAVLAP activity for continual assessment of the lab's competence. The CMVP happens to provide the assessors because they have technical competence in that area. But it's a NAVLAP activity report review. And that's how the continued competence of the labs hopefully is maintained. And I will say, I have personally visited all 28 laboratories. I think there's 23 today. Some have come and gone over the years. I've done more audits than all the assessors combined today have ever done. And the competence that one finds in the laboratories is excellent. And in many cases, during audits, we would learn something as assessors from the laboratories. So laboratories are, you will find, are very competent entities. And the process, hopefully, is also geared to maintain that competence. Then there was the creation of the validation program, the CMVP. And then later, the emergence of the cryptographic algorithm validation program. I think that was like 2003. The goal of creating the CAVP was to have a program that focused on the cryptography itself. FIPS 140-1 or -2 is not really a crypto standard. It's a standard on how to build crypto widgets, boxes that include cryptography, but really, how do they protect the keys? That's what the standard really is focused on. Cryptography is the annexes, the user approved algorithms. So the CAVP, the creation of that program was to focus on the algorithms, algorithm testings, everything to do with algorithms. And that would free up the CAVP, the cryptographic module validation program, to focus on those things in 140-1-2 related to physical security, authentication, self-tests, documentation, and all those things that are in the standard. So what does the CMVP do? It works with NAVLAP, provides the assessors for the NAVLAP assessment of the continuous competency and, you know, other things that NAVLAP requires for accreditation. And they will also validate the test results that, or the test reports that do come from the testing laboratories, which says the module is indeed conformant to the standard, and they post that publicly on the validation list. CMVP also provides guidance and program management. When I say guidance, which is implementation guidance, that's the name of the document. I think it's called FIPS 140-2 and CMVP implementation guidance. I largely wrote that document originally. That document is really to explain areas in the standard that maybe over the years is getting different interpretations. As a standards writer, you can write paragraphs and sentences that make perfect sense, and a month later you read it and it looks like I wrote a recipe for baking a cake. It makes no sense. It's a tough job. So over the years, FIPS 140-2, for example, has been out there now for 15 years. That's a long time. And during that time, new technologies have emerged, new types of modules. And implementation guidance is a way to say this is how the standard can be interpreted, how the standard, not reinterpreted, but how the standard can be used for these new things. Cannot change the standard unless it goes back through the Secretary of Department of Commerce. There were four change notices early in the standard in 2002, where we removed the statistical test for the RNGs and a couple other typos that were updated. So there is a clear process if one wants to change the standard. So in the little box, I want to highlight that the Validation Authority also cannot provide design assistance to manufacturers or vendors. It is a conflict of interest. If the CMVP says, if you build it this way, we will pass it or it will be conformant, then the CMVP becomes liable in case that it turns out there's a vulnerability or a problem in that. So the CMVP cannot provide design guidance. The CMVP can help explain what the meaning in the standard is and provide education. So that's a very important thing because it is clearly a conflict of interest for a validation program to do that activity. So I'll go back to my personal experience, which is the emergence of FIPS 140-1. As we said, it was published in 1994. So where I worked, again at IBM, we moved on to a new technology, CMOS technology, which is everything's kind of built today, finally got density and performance fast enough to do that emitter-coupled logic does without taking the same amount of power or boxes with motor generator sets to generate power. So we took those 100 ASICs and the key storage unit and squashed it down into a single chip, which we, again, the cryptographic coprocessor. And this was available in 1996 on various different versions of the ES9000 servers. Unfortunately, it takes a long time to design very complex chips and go through the testing and process. In addition to all the operating system software and everything that needs to run to support that, under the OS390 operating system. So we really had, I had heard about this work going on down in, with my other colleagues in IBM on this draft of FIPS 140-1, which is a standard for design for compliance. And so we tried to design our chip to be compliant to that standard whenever it got published. So, you know, you got some risk there. In addition, our design was done, it was built, and we're waiting for labs to come out so we can get it tested for conformance. They came out in July 1995. I believe that when the program emerged in 1995, a new standard, new labs, they felt that this thing would start slowly, software modules, level one, kind of simple, and they gradually over the years worked their way up. And we walked in the door with 100% hardware gate design, not a stitch of code, and our target level was level four. We spent a lot of time with the laboratories in education, with NIST, CMVP, or CMVP in education. I think the most complex computer NIST had was a desktop PC. They didn't know much about mainframes. So there's a lot of education in our case in the process to let them know this is what it is, how it works, and this is why it is conformant to the standard. We eventually got certificate number 40, which is the first single chip overall level 4. But unfortunately, we have a caveat. We could not generate keys internally because the random bit generator we had was not one of the approved NIST random bit generators because our design was done. It met all the requirements of the standard. The NIST decided, oh, here's the three approved ones after the fact. Wasn't one of ours. We visited NIST, explained to them why ours was better. They agreed, but they said, sorry, but it's not one of ours. So we couldn't generate keys internally. The next iteration, we threw one of their RNGs on the output of ours just so we could get it tested. So validations, milestones of the program, CERT 1 in October 1995, a level 1 software module, 96, the first level 1 hardware module, CERT 2. As you go on to the, I just listed the different levels and the different types, single chip, multi-chip, embedded, multi-chip, standalone, CERT 40. IBM Hawthorne, who's in a sense our internal competitor, and Steve Weingart is here, he was integral in designing our over-engineered brick on the prior machine. They got actually the first level 4 for a multi-chip standalone a little bit before us, because we got hung up in our education and RBG thing going on. So we received both level 4s as a company for those two products. When I created these foils, these slides, a few weeks ago, up to cert 2626, I think it's beyond that today because they're getting updated daily. That was a hardware level 3 module, multi-chip standalone, and I believe that company is located in China. So the program has gone very international, has grown over the years. And why has it grown? Well, one, there's no longer with FSMA 2002 a statutory provision to allow federal agencies to waive the FIPS requirements. And that standard is applicable to all federal agencies that use crypto-based security systems to protect federal protect sensitive information, and you can read that, and it's in the by law, by public law. So after 2002, because now it's required for federal agencies to procure validated modules, the number of validations greatly soared. And you can see a little graph there on the very far left is the first one in 1996, and it just continually grows. This graph takes us up to, I think, October of 2014. I don't have the numbers after that point. So tremendous growth as far as in addition to the varying types of cryptographic modules, single chip, multi-chip, thumb drives, hard disk drives, software modules, modules in international space stations on reconnaissance satellites, underwater military purposes, smart bombs, smart munitions. All those things have crypto built into them. As the speaker this morning said, crypto's everywhere. And the CMVP has been able to been exposed to all those MIRE technologies and implementations, which also leads to one, it is hard to write a standard that here's the requirements that has to apply to any technology, any embodiment of a crypto module, hardware or software or combination thereof. PIPS 140-2 seems to be have been written in a manner that has allowed that. It's 15 years old and oldie but goodie, but time for change. So a little bit on the standards timeline. We talked about 140-1 in 1994, first three labs in 1995, FIPS 140-2, again, a Federal Register notice, public comments, what did you like, what don't you like, what do you want changed, went through that process, and FIPS 140-2 was published in May of 2001. About a year or so after that was published, we started getting a lot of international interest in using the standard, but a lot of international interest in not using a U.S. standard. You know, many countries, you know, they don't want to say, I'm using a U.S. standard. There's some stigma with that. So we thought it was a good idea to move forward and publish FIPS 140-2 as an international standard. And that was published in 2006. It is technically equivalent to FIPS 140-2, except in the areas of using classified random bit generators. We can't let, you know, other countries use our classified random bit generators. But we also introduced, we took the opportunity to rewrite things to make it clearer, introduce the concept of critical security parameters, different terminology and things, to improve upon the standard based on lessons learned from the 140-1, 140-2 usage. The revision, or the second edition of 19790 was published in 2012. And I'll go over in the next slide briefly what those additions or differences have been incorporated in that standard. A lot of new things added to the second edition. And so we'll talk about that briefly and then the correction that we did last December, which was published December 15th. And just to give you a little comparison, we'll talk about the effort at FIPS 140-3. That effort started in January 2005 with the Federal Register notice, same process. The goal at that time, our goal at that time, was to develop 140-3 and the ISO standard, second edition, in parallel, together, to create a common standard with a different cover. That was the goal. We had a physical security workshop. It was tough. It was in Hawaii in September 2005, and I'll talk in the next slide what came out of that, to get public input, manufacturer, vendor input on, you know, what's new in the area of physical security that might be useful for the protection of, based on the security level of CSPs. We had the first draft was published in July of 2007. I believe that first draft had a lot of eclectic ideas in it. Well, one thing you do put out a draft is say things to get responses, and just to see if somebody's reading it. Received 1,500 technical comments, I think more comments than words in the standard, unfortunately. The two areas that we had a lot of comments was software security and side channel testing, non-invasive attacks. So we held a software security workshop in March of 2008. What can we do in the area of software modules? 140-1 was really a hardware standard. -2 introduced operational environment in attempting to accommodate software-only modules, not very well, and we wanted to correct that. So we had a one-day conference and got a lot of feedback on that. The last draft that was published of -3 was in December of 2009, and we move on. So the physical security workshop, we focused a lot of feedback on side channel attacks that we received, and a lot of discussion, how can you generate a set of conformance tests for the mitigation of side channel attacks, where generally that's an evaluation and an interpretation and a lot of work to evaluate a module, but how can you do something that's cut and dried, a conformance test, back to our thing, cost and time and effort, and be a cut and dried conformance test. And I'll talk about that tomorrow with the ISO standards that we've introduced on that. That's in C11B, just a little promotion there. We also looked at the EFP-EFT, which was at levels 3 and 4, we changed it so at level 4 it has to be EFP, and also we introduced the mitigation of fault induction attacks at level 4. A lot of the other things in physical security pretty much remain the same. So you notice the note in the bottom, it needs a refresh. So the next version of the ISO standard, the third edition, we need to put more effort into the physical security section, especially the testing, where today, at certain levels, the labs are allowed to use certain tools and not allowed to use certain tools, and some of that today is kind of silly, and that really needs to be refreshed in the area of physical security. And now today, with the internet, you can go buy lots of very sophisticated equipment off of eBay and Amazon, and so the type of attacks that can be mounted today are different than 15 years ago when the standard was written, FIPS 140-2. The software security workshop in 2008, again focusing on software modules. We therefore created a new section in 1997-90 specifically for software security. That whole section explicitly defines the boundary of a software module, which was not really defined well in 140-2. And unfortunately, even though we had the workshop, not a lot of really good ideas came out to really address this topic. We hope, since that's been a few years ago, what's it, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I think that section needs to be refreshed as well. There was some talk this morning about various types of static testing and other things to do with software modules. These are all great things, and we need people who have input and ideas on that for that section. There will be a talk, I think tomorrow, G4B, and that's titled "Huh, Must Be Encrypted," where Yi here will talk about one of the aspects in the change that I think if you're a software vendor, you should attend. It will have impact. on software modules. We removed the level 2 CC requirements, specifically requirements on the operating system, and consensus out of the software was that level 3 and 4 didn't make any sense for software. Partial changes, precise boundaries, all services have to provide an approved, non-approved indicator, trusted channel requirements, requirement for a callable service for the versioning, a degraded mode of operation, two-factor authentication at level 4, fault induction mitigation, the side channel non-invasive mitigation, self-tests where the algorithmic self-tests were moved to conditional, life cycle insurance including end of life, and also algorithms that national bodies or validation authorities can decide for their usage what are approved algorithms, which can be different than what ISO has as far as standards. So, ISO standards. We start with 19790. The revision was the correction published last year. It's companion document 24759, which is really the test requirements. So for each shall statement, this is what the vendor has to do, this is what the lab has to do. It also was updated same time, December 15th of last year. They're now completely in sync, same date. We have another standard that's ready to be published on how to approach testing of algorithms. 17825 on testing for the pass-fail metrics for the non-invasive side-channel test was published in January. Two additional standards in development, which is to focus on how to set up the test environment for side channel testing and how to calibrate that environment so you get consistent results from regardless of which testing lab you go to. Testing for random bit generators. I know there's work in NIST for 90B and 90C, a special publication. That's been going on, I think, most of my lifetime. There was a workshop recently, still a lot of questions there. We think in the ISO arena that something is better than nothing. Today we have nothing. So we're trying to put something together that's practical on getting assurance on entropy that can be conformance test for random bit generators. And then we have two other standards that address competency of testers and validators. If validators are going to validate the test results, they should know it just as well, the technologies and standards, as well as the testers. And since they also provide services as assessors, they also need that knowledge. So this, depending, regardless of the validation program or programs that are out there, like JCMVP, KCMVP, et cetera, there should be a level set as far as competence. And there's another document that was published last year or so on various physical security attack mechanisms and mitigation things. So this is a whole suite of ISO standards addressed towards cryptographic modules. And lastly, a module for, okay, I'm a user, I bought this module, what do I do now? How do I set it up? How do I use it? What things should I be concerned about? That's 2540. Now we're going to move into the changes in the revision or the correction last December. I tried to highlight it. These are all the sections that changed. You have access to the slides. A lot of it was, a lot of the changes were really editorial. Our colleagues at the JCMVP in Japan are excellent in understanding correct English, better than I am, and generally find those editorial corrections. One thing that we did correct, change, that was technical, you'll see in green there is error detection code. In the conference, ICMC conference in 2014, we got feedback from generally the smart card vendors that using a SHA-hash for the power-up integrity test takes too long. And they said, we really like the EDC that was in FIPS 140-2. And so we took that information from this conference, went back, and we made the change. What this illustrates is the process to change even the ISO standard can be done, and can be done fairly quickly. That change went from the fall meeting in 2014 to December, 1 year, to make that update and change. That's faster than we have FIPS 140-3. So we can make changes in the ISO standard. It's not hard. And again, the rest of the things are really relatively minor. Again, if you look at the other changes, the return to factory state or include level 3 in the documentation, they're largely editorial typos. So Now you'll see why I couldn't spend a whole 50 minutes talking about the changes to the correction, because there's not a lot. And also in the annexes, that also ripples effect the EDC change into the annexes. Where can you buy these standards? From the ISO website, it's in, I think, Swiss francs. They have also been adopted as ANSI standards. So it's not only an ISO standard, it's actually an American national standard. It's an ANSI standard. So if someone says, well, you're using an ISO standard, it's an international standard, well, it's an American standard too. It was adopted by ANSI. And you can buy it there. I think it's a little cheaper. The two together is $250. I believe there's rumblings from NIST that they may use taxpayer dollars and give some for free, but I don't know what they're doing. 17825, it was published by ISO. It's still pending to be adopted by ANSI. So what's next? We need a refreshment, third edition. Feedback from industry, testing laboratories. Good talk this morning about CMUF and bringing together all those people. We need the ISO folks to be involved in that as well. We need work as far as defined boundaries, software, firmware security I talked about. Physical security needs to be updated. Authentication, we have no authentication standards today. I think that's an area that needs a lot of work. So in conclusion, the mission and the rationale for this program, for this standard, was a federal requirement that the federal government said, the federal government does not want to purchase the module unless it has this minimum set of requirements that can be independently tested to give us a baseline level of assurance. The government simply said, that's what we want. It's really, you know, we want public input to make sure what we want doesn't make sense, but it's a requirement. So that the federal agencies at least have a baseline of assurance that if a module from vendor A passed physical security and vendor B passed the same thing, you know they were tested the same way, got the same results. And as we move on, the things that we need to keep in mind is cost and time and effort. We still need to focus on that. Security is a broad topic, covers a lot of things. There's a lot of things in security. There's a lot of things you may want to do that takes too much time, too much cost, and can't be done in conformance. You can't do it in this program. That's a different program. And there may be new programs that emerge. So we need industry, government, testing laboratories, and input for the next revision. Anybody can join their national body group. They'll become members and provide that input. If you do, you have access to all ISO documents in SC27, which is the security section of of ISO. Once you buy your copy, you get a free copy from NIST and you have things, send it to me. I can be your conduit to taking it to ISO as well. But we need your input. Some people believe so, but I know it's a fact. I don't know everything. So in the end, and any questions that you may have?
We have 1 minute to take some questions.
Yeah.
If you have.
Time this just perfectly. Yes.
Thanks very much for an excellent talk. Forgive me if this is obvious to everybody, but does this mean that this will then be adopted as the 140-3 standard this year?
My understanding is that NIST is, and I think there's a talk, not the one after this one, but the next one, that the CMVP will be here on the stage. And that would be a good question for what they plan to do in using the international standard. I hope any national body or validation body uses the ISO standards, not just NIST. Any other questions? Yes.
We're wondering about how often you expect changes to the document to
be. Okay.
There's not just one now. There's a whole bunch of auxiliary ones.
Yes.
So they would all have to change, and there could be changes to this.
Could be. Yes. So ISO would like to open up every document on a 5-year basis for revision. 5 years, this was published in 2012, 5 years is next year. We would like, and what we conveyed to the our working group at the last meeting this spring, was we'd like to have some national body, some validation authority, actually adopt and use the standard first so we could get feedback of actual use before the next revision. Because if you're making a revision for something that's been used, you're probably missing some things. Right now we have the 2.2.4.7.5.9 in sync. They would also be changed in sync, either with corrections, technical corrigendums, or an actual revision. The other standards are pretty much not tied to the base standard. Because the base standard simply says if you want to mitigate it's non-invasive, go see this standard. And so 17.2.5 and the others completely address that. Yes?
The more recent common criteria protection profile documents have moved away from referencing NIST-SPs to referencing ISO documents. Is there going to be coordination effort between common criteria and NIST to make sure that references are as close in conjunction as possible?
Another good question for the CMVP person that comes up here.
For the audio recording, could you repeat the question?
Yes. The question was, CC seems to be using more ISO standards or moving towards using ISO standards. Is NIST going to be moving in that direction as well? I think that captured the question. And my answer is that's a good question for NIST or the CMVP talk two talks from now.
Okay.
So thank you very much. Okay.
Was that useful?
Yes, very useful.
Sarah, you're the next. So since yours is, I think it was 25 minutes. I will give you 5 minutes reminder and then I'll
understanding, because since it was reprinted in its entirety, I think you got to buy the whole thing again. So I would strongly
Okay.
Until Ms. is going to give out some free-